This episode is sponsored by SEAT in support of Campaign Against Living Miserably Mental Health Charity. Many of you will know SEAT as one of the leading, fastest growing car manufacturers in Europe. But what you may not know is that during the pandemic in 2020, SEAT donated a significant sum to Calm that was used to provide additional staff for Calm's helpline, which is operated by trained mental health professionals and provides support to those struggling with their mental well-being. During the pandemic, 9 in 10 people turned to their cars and went for a drive to manage their mental health. With this knowledge, SEAT took the initiative to install a mental health SOS sticker in the vanity mirror of every SEAT car, which included a QR code directing the user to Calm's website for helpful tips on ways to manage your mental health. The number for Calm's helpline is also there for those who needed it. Throughout 2020, all senior management at SEAT were also given mental health first aid training, ensuring they can support anyone who contacts them who's struggling. These are huge steps forward that all companies, big and small, can take inspiration from. Like Take Flight, SEAT has supported Calm since 2018, so it's such a pleasure for all three of us to be able to collaborate this year for Mental Health Awareness Week. As part of this campaign, we created some special episodes for this podcast, as well as creating educational videos on practices that any of us can use to boost our mood and manage our mental health. To view these videos, or learn more about the practices, or anything SEAT, Calm, and I are creating, follow at SEAT UK, at SEAT underscore UK underscore media, at CalmZone, and follow me at MarkWitto underscore TF on your social media channel of choice. Our relationship with our mental health is a lifelong journey. Where are you on yours?
The surgery went fine. They hear cancer. They hear years, not months. But they also hear unlikely decade. So that is my process with them. And they respond. I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, man. It's their interior life. Some are braced. Some don't say anything. Some cry. Of course, they cry. Some wail. But I don't know what they're thinking inside. And I don't know if I ever can until I get to that moment. And even then, it'll be my own journey.
Welcome to Take Flight with me, Mark Whittle. This is season 12 and the 113th episode I've released in nearly 4 years. And season 12 is our life lessons season, because every soul that travels this planet has a unique journey. And each individual at some stage in their life will have a major moment where they learn lessons that can transform them. Of course, for some, these moments are bigger than others. And this season of Take Flight is all about speaking with those who have had multiple major moments in their life in order to get to where they are. And hearing these stories is our chance to learn from their experiences. The idea for this series of episodes is also to learn from those who have walked a path that we will never walk, and therefore learn lessons that perhaps we could never have learned ourselves. And oh my God, has this guest walked a unique path. Our guest for episode 113 of Take Flight is Dr. Rahul Jundiaal. Rahul is an American brain surgeon and neuroscientist based at the City of Hope Research Center and Hospital in Los Angeles. He is a professor with expertise in the surgical treatment of cancer, specifically of the nervous system. After completing his neurosurgical training and doctorate at the University of California, he was accepted into a fellowship at Stanford University and subsequently recruited as a faculty at Harvard. Dr. Jundiaal is the world leader in the study and the improvement of brain function. He has performed thousands of procedures to resect cancer from people's brains, as well as other trauma operations. He's also diagnosed thousands of people with cancer and prolonged many of his patients' lives through his life-changing surgery. Through these many journeys, he's been exposed to the human being's highest highs and our lowest lows. And his new book, Life on a Knife's Edge, details all this. It is truly one of the best books I've read, harrowing in parts, heartbreaking, but deeply moving too. This episode was special. We talk about what Rahul has learned observing humans facing death and the journey he has undertaken to understand cancer and ideally find a cure. We also discuss the similarities Snoop Dogg, Nipsey Hussle and Harry Potter have in common with Rahul. He was so generous with his time. We spoke for nearly 2 hours and believe it or not, I still have questions for him. But because of the length of this conversation, we've split the episode into two parts to be more easily digestible. Part two will drop on the Wednesday morning after part one is released. Subscribe to the podcast on your platform of choice to hear the other life lessons in this season first. But it's my honor to share the following story. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon with Dr. Rahul Jundiaal. Thanks for listening. Rahul, welcome to the Take Flight podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for including me.
Do you know what? I actually got called out for this the other day because I always say I've been so excited for this naturally because the people I speak to are amazing. But I have been so excited for this for a long time. I read your first book a while back. I was lucky enough to get the new one here, advanced copy, which was, I felt very, very special to get the advanced copy. And it's just blown my mind completely.
Thank you, brother.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. So congratulations on that, first of all.
Yeah, it was something. I wrote it mostly the rough draft while I was in the garage for a few months while the pandemic was exploding, you know, February 2020. And so just all that time, that isolation, that pressure just kind of just came out. Now when I try to write, I'm like, wait a second, it sounds shallow compared to what's in there. So it's an interesting thing where crisis can reveal or release creativity, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny as well. I think you find books at a time that you need them a lot of the times anyway, not always. But with this one, it fell in my hands just as I needed it, particularly the part about self, which I'd love to dive in today into. Before we do that, there's a couple other things I wanted to just mention before we start. A couple other commonalities. So I don't know whether you'd know them. I don't know whether this was the stuff that you use as far as with your studying, but I knew him as Uncle Alwyn, but my great uncle was William Alwyn Lishman, the author of Organic Psychiatry. And I don't know whether you use that textbook at all in your studies, but over in the UK, it was like the biggest textbook for neuroscience and psychiatry. So I had that from a young age, being exposed to that and learning about the mind and psychiatry and all that sort of stuff. And then 10 years ago, my mum had, I wrote it down to get the actual term right, an astrocytoma.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the biggest traumatic events in my life, was her going through that and having surgery. So
is she okay?
She is okay, thankfully. Yeah. It was in the frontal lobe. So some other questions I was going to ask you about around.
You bet. Yeah.
You know, perhaps like personality changes and stuff like that. So
I'm glad she's doing well. Not everybody does. So that's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you. So yeah, look, Rahul, I'd love to just start with asking you about your week, what a typical week looks like. We've never spoke to a brain surgeon or any surgeon for that matter on the podcast. So what happens, you know, you start on a Monday morning, how does the week play out for you usually?
Well, you know, my week is very different than most surgeons. So I'll first share with you what is the usual surgical practice, and then tell you what I'm doing. It's a bit different. So first of all, surgeons don't operate every day. In medical school, when we choose between surgery and non-surgery, people think surgeons are operating every day. No, you got to have a couple of days of clinic where you see people who may benefit from an operation and where you see the people that have received an operation that you need to follow back through rehabilitation. So usually surgeons operate 2 days a week, have clinic 2 days a week. In clinic, they write prescriptions. They do all those things that physicians do. And then they go to the shop and they operate. I always like that, the variety of the week. And then there's maybe a day where it's administrative. And if you do stuff that's hardcore, you know, heart surgery, trauma surgery, brain surgery, transplant surgery, then you got to know that the nights and weekends are not yours. I mean, you can try to structure it to where you have people you share your practice with, but if you put a liver in somebody or you do a big brain surgery on somebody and it's not, and the weekend is somebody else's to cover and that person is having trouble, you want to go back in. That's your patient. That's your work. So it's not really a handoff kind of practice if you go into hardcore surgery. So people need to know that. You know, my path, yeah, I didn't engineer it, brother. I mean, it's like, you know, I had dropped out of university for a while. I was working as a security guard, went to medical school, thought I was going to be a pediatrician, ended up being a surgeon, thought I was going to be a heart surgeon. They fired somebody in neurosurgery and needed somebody. So I jumped ship and got, I was a battlefield pickup. I mean, it's been like that. I mean, it's not, it's not from a young age I wanted any of this. I'm just willing to go for it. And then when I was in training for brain surgery, you know, I went to the lab for a couple of years and picked up a PhD. That was interesting because then my current employer, City of Hope Cancer Center, said, you're 35, you're fresh out the gates. We'll make you a professor and we'll ask you to run a lab half your week and do cancer surgery the other half. So I said, wait a second, I got to take that shot. It's a very difficult thing to be both, but I had young kids, you know, 3, 5, 7, or 8, you know, like that range. And many of the surgeons I know, they had, you know, missed the time with their children. So I saw this as an opportunity to like have a cooler career, make a bigger impact, have more time with the kids. It was just like, it was a potential dream. And then I've had to make it work. So right now, as a surgeon, I would say I'm 2 days a week. And as a scientist, I'm 3 days a week. But science is in the ether. You know, you don't sit down and do science. You just talk, you just think about it all the time. The ideas, the creativity. How does a cancer cell grow? Why does it grow here? Why does it grow there? So you're just riffing in your mind about the ideas. You don't, it's not like allocated time to do it. And so I have a lot of time. And I have a lot going on in my mind, and I just try to mix all of that. And I'm just really grateful for where my life has taken me. It isn't without complexity and tragedy, but I'm grateful for the nuance and the depths it's revealing to me at this age of 48.
Sound like the stars aligned for you with that is amazing. I mean, for people who are listening on audio as well, you have to Google a picture of Rahul. Incredibly good looking, handsome man. Is it fair to say that
Photoshop is excellent?
is it fair to say that you're not your sort of stereotypical surgeon?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, you know, I'm into the patient stories. So most of the surgeons, we're speaking in generalizations, but I love the craft, but in brain surgery, the stories are amazing. The ways that people change from the disease they carry before they see you to the ways they may be altered after you do your surgery. I mean, it's just, thousands of patients I've operated on, and I've met thousands even more, right? You don't operate on everybody you see. Just the exposure to humanity is something I'm just, and through my own struggle, through what's going on in my life, what's going on in the patients' lives, my kids are older. This book is really a synthesis of that, filled with optimism, filled with insight that I think whatever station or place you are in your life, that there's something in there you'll connect with, whether it's whether it's a tragedy or a triumph. You know, there's stuff in there with that. So it's been a real special thing that they would give me a chance to share those thoughts, those heavy titles, you know, trauma, self, threat. I mean, they were like, these are themes in themselves. I said, let me have a shot at it because I want to bring insight to it from my cancer patients' journeys, like what I've seen through them on those topics. So it's not really, it doesn't have a lot of philosophy in there, but like, how does can you imagine being a cancer patient? I know you mentioned your mom, and my mom also had breast cancer when I was young. She's doing fine. And man, you go in and get those scans. That's trauma every time. You're in the machine, and then you're waiting. Did it show something? You know, am I going to spiral based on the findings, or am I going to spiral upward? That's a lot to just brace for privately, usually, and repeatedly for cancer patients. So watching how people handled it was, I mean, it was a masterclass in studying, you know, coping and, you know, the way they don't just endure, they some of them thrive, some of them blossom. I'm not saying I want cancer. I'm just saying that if it occurs, they have some people, not all of them been triumphant. Some have suffered badly, no question, but some have surprised me with what they have found, meaning, purpose. And that's sort of the stuff I'm writing about in this book, is the lessons and the insights.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable. As I said, I loved reading the book so much. And it's strange because, like, through trauma or through, in your patient's cases, cancer, or, you know, for my example, I had chronic fatigue for like 7 years. And that was one of the best educations I ever had in self, in life. And you can learn that yourself through those experiences, but also you can learn things like you have through your patients. And I know you've also had your own experiences of trauma. But that's an education in itself. In the same way, when I speak with a guest for the podcast, I can learn huge amounts through what they've experienced themselves. So as far as I was concerned, like, who better to have a book about that than yourself, who's experienced so much. Like, that education is very, very unique. Like, there's only so many people who have seen the things that you've seen. What would you say? Because I can't imagine that everybody has reacted in a positive way when they hear news like you've got cancer. Like, I don't think you would ever see that for yourself in your life. So when people hear those words, like, what's a typical reaction? And then what are like the kind of the more negative responses and the more positive responses that you've seen?
So there are, I want to give that answer, but I also want to provide sort of nuance and complexity to something like that, right? So for example, if you've never had cancer and you have a lump and you have a biopsy, that's a different sharing of that diagnosis than you've had cancer and you get your usual scans, you know, and you think they're clean, they're going to be clean, and then you have to hear that your cancer has come back. So like, there are a lot of layers about that. Mm. Or the biopsy you've heard now in clinic is positive for breast cancer or some kind of cancer. Now you go to surgery and you're wondering, is it going to be just where it grew, removable and curable? Or is it going to have spread locally and that changes your whole trajectory? So when you talk about like sharing the diagnosis of cancer, I mean, there's a world of complexity there, right? And what I try to see is every patient and where they're at and how to share that with them. When somebody gets a diagnosis of brain cancer, they're going in a bit guarded because the pictures hint towards it being cancer. We don't know how bad or what type, but they go in a bit braced. So those patients afterwards, at recovering from surgery, you have to be thoughtful that they may be on morphine, which is in the hospital given for pain. So their emotional response, I'm not just talking about being groggy, right? I mean, it changes your perception of crisis and joy. I mean, the effects of opioids on the mind are more than just numbing. Mm. They create an optimism in some of my patients. So when you share that information, you kind of have to look and see, are we really having this conversation while they're on morphine, or do I wait and come back 8 hours later, or give them a piece of the information now, let them brace the next, you know? So there are a lot of layers. And what I do is, I give them time, because what I've learned is, I mean, thousands of patients I've talked to about cancer, but for that patient, it's that first conversation. And if I go in there and I motor, you know, the surgery went fine, I did want to share with you the little piece of that tissue we took out was put under a microscope by the other experts, and it's looking like it is cancer. You know, if you just keep going through that, I mean, can you imagine being on the other side? Like, wait, surgery. So I like to have these awkward moments of silence. They're awkward for me. But, you know, then you need a minute to really replenish psychologically that surgery went fine. In my mind, if I know it went fine yesterday or like hours ago, I'm already on to the next thing. But mm-hmm. surgery went fine. And then you can see them fill up. That's a big deal, because it's, I mean, surviving and coming out of brain surgery and moving and thinking, that by itself warrants, deserves a bit of a pause. So you let them fill up. And then you have to, because that actually helps them focus for what's coming next. And then depending on the language, depending on their cognitive function, because sometimes the cancer can disrupt how they think, depending on if family is around, depending on if they have a good relationship with their family. I mean, you see it all in the hospital. I love the masterclass of a hospital. I mean, just the most complex human interactions in one building. That's always fascinated me. So I liked when I do share with them that it looks, you know, it is cancer, then I just wait. I just let them free fall. Yeah, because everybody comes into it. Maybe they had a loved one. Maybe they have a genetic risk. Maybe they saw something on TV. Maybe, you know, you just got to let people, you got to bring it to them fairly, clearly, let them hear that authenticity in your voice, and then just, you know, let them go on that journey on their own. That, you know, so I have this, it's not a structure, you know, but it's a process. I found letting them and then have that air knocked out of them with that word is that's their right to run through their whole mind about what it means to hear the C word. And in my opinion, that's when they see that proverbial white light, you know, that end of life white light. All of a sudden, the finish line is visible. It might be, and then that's when I like to speak in ways in which people understand. And I say, well, but as we discussed, with treatments, you may choose. Not that I offer. you came to me in your time of crisis, and now I'm offering you decisions that empower you. I'm not working for the hospital. I'm not working for anybody. I'm just letting you know, in the world, here are the approaches people take. Some don't do anything. Others go for everything on the treatment menu. And I let them know that if you do, that years are in your future, but unlikely decades. And to me, that has worked well for them, because right away they're thinking months. Oh my God, oh my gosh, oh my God. You know, and then you say years, and you can see them fill up again that, okay, I've got some time for whatever they imagine. The finish line is in sight, but it's not right up on me. But you also have to be fair that you can't, if only one out of 100 patients has made it a decade, and you know, your mom's cancer, I don't know the details, but the ones I'm dealing with are people whose cancers have spread all over their body, or, you know, advanced, you know, brain cancer. It's an overwhelming majority only live a few years. So I try to, I don't say you can make it a decade. I'm not trying to take away the miracle for them, but to me, that's been the right way, that years, because they're only hearing words, you know, they're not hearing the prognosis might be this, and with these treatment options, you may have this kind of, what is that? I mean, I can't understand that, brother. So they hear years, they hear cancer, the surgery went fine, they hear cancer, they hear years, not months, but they also hear unlikely decade. So that is my process with them, and they respond. I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, man, it's their interior life. Some are braced. Some don't say anything. Some cry. Of course, they cry. Some wail. But I don't know what they're thinking inside. And I don't know if I ever can until I get to that moment. And even then, it'll be my own journey. So it's the whole world of cancer is just so it offers such a rare insight into the complexity of humanity. I'm grateful to my patients. And I'm still learning from them.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's so fascinating to hear. Like, is it so normal for you? And I'm sitting here, I'm in awe listening to how you explain people hearing probably the scariest thing they're ever going to face.
And I'm a cancer surgeon, not a plastic surgeon, you know, that chose this.
You know, Rahul, I'd love to talk a little bit later about the journey to that. Take Flight has a lot about how you got into the career that you got into. I know you've spoken and written about how it wasn't the traditional path. But before we do, I'm fascinated just with what you shared about how patients cope with hearing things like that. Like, what have you taken from that yourself and applied into your own life, whether you're facing, you know, trauma or dealing with any type of stress? Like, do you take anything from your patients?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this whole book is about. In the beginning, I thought about, you know, in the beginning, you're just trying to take care of them. You sometimes miss the story there that they bring, because you're actually just thinking about the technical aspects of your job. And I'd say that was me in my 30s. And then as you care for patients long enough, you see them through their journey for the few years, and, you know, I've taken care of thousands of patients, and thousands of patients have died also. And you start to think about what is the meaning here? These waves of cancer patients that come, my connection with them for moments, for months usually. And then they move on and you get the invitation to the funeral and you get the thank you for caring for our mom or something like that. And you're just, all of that is washing through you in some way, right? And and only now in my 40s am I starting to think about that. And I think what I've learned then, and it can't be taught, is that no one can take this journey for me, especially this last year, man. They were getting cancer surgery and coming out, and there's not even somebody waiting for them. Families weren't allowed in the hospitals. I mean, they're in the ICU. There's nobody there. I mean, think about that. You're getting cancer surgery and cancer treatment alone, and everybody's got masks on and all this stuff on their face. You cannot be, you know, that journey, no one can go on that with you. That's what I've learned. I mean, there isn't a simple takeaway here. But like, I've learned to do this, 1, 2, 3, you know, that those tips that people are being offered in sort of pop psychology, I think is creating a wave of frustration when they don't work or they don't apply. It's hard to say, be mindful. You had cancer surgery, you got a cancer diagnosis, and everybody you're seeing has got goggles and masks. You can't even read their energy, or their mouth or movement, you know, even their eyes. You're in there alone. And so no one can take the journey for us. And also no one can spare us from the journey. You know, life at times is difficult. And that's not meant to be pessimistic or depressing, but that's the clarity I have gained from my cancer patients, that whether they go into it and they have, you know, constructive coping mechanisms, or they go into a destructive coping mechanisms, you know, I prefer, whether they get these titles of at addiction or anxious or a lot of times, you know, non-compliant. That's the most bizarre hospital term I've ever heard. He's non-compliant with his meds. Well, that's his choice. You know, that's her choice. What do you mean non-compliant? They're electing to take those pills, and maybe they take some, maybe they don't. That's their journey. And so wherever they are in that, I have seen the widest range of it. And what I will tell you is, I don't assume that I am strong enough or have seen enough that I'm going to be on the spectrum of well-being versus distress if that calamity hit me. Because I might be a poor coper. I might have some destructive habits for a while. I might not. I don't know. But what I do know is, if and when that moment arrives, that I have developed, I'm going to use this word very carefully, resilience. It's overused, but I have developed some fortitude through age and experience. Yet if I stumble or if I struggle, that doesn't mean I didn't have it before that moment. It just means maybe the hit was that hard. And I saw this in children's hospitals when they lost their children. You know, the death of a child, who am I to say you're not resilient or you are resilient? Wait a second. Look, I can't put myself in those shoes. I might be the most balanced, the owner of my own well-being, and that moment hits, and I might just, you know, I might be an addict. I might commit suicide. I've seen wonderful families, wonderful people just fall apart after the death of a child. I don't assign the title of they were resilient or not resilient. So when I thought about this term, I started reading, you know, like you mentioned about your grandfather, and there's two types of resilience. The engineering definition is, you know, you push something and it bends and it comes back to form. But the psychological definition is very different. And there's two types. One is systemic resilience. So simply put, that's the fight you have in you. Earthquake happens, pandemic happens, you maintain. You don't get rocked. That's the That's systemic resilience. You might just have it, or you might have built it through a life. Okay, that's, and then there's processive resilience. That's the resilience you're about to demonstrate. That's the fight in you you didn't know you had. And that's what the world is going through in this last year, right? We all got rocked. And now we're going to see, there's no way to prepare for last year, right? You can't be like, well, I was resilient coming in and I'm resilient coming out. No, you we all came in with a certain amount of resilience and coping mechanisms, good ones, bad ones. And now this year was a global test, a stress test of our minds. And now there's an opportunity, despite how we are at this moment, falling apart or on the rise, to demonstrate the resilience that's in us, right? It's not just the fight you have in you. It's the fight you're going to demonstrate now that you're engaged in this crisis. So that is a bigger, more inclusive definition of resilience. It's actually the accurate one for psychological resilience. So wherever you are at this moment, that's not your full story. You might have come in strong. You might have come in weak. Whatever's happening now, you might fumble in the future, or you might, in that moment, you might, something surprising might come up from you, a strength that no one saw in you that you didn't see in yourself. That way, people feel possibility when they hear the word resilience. And so that's what I mentioned in the book as well. That's an accurate neuropsychological definition. A lot of times we don't have room for that in the magazines and TV shows, right? Like it's considered a static trait. Are you resilient or not? Are you tall or not? Mm-hmm. Are you brown or not? It's not like that. It's dynamic. So that's what I've learned from my patients.
Unbelievable. So just to clarify on the resilience thing, because I think that's huge. So many people, as you rightly said, talk about resilience and the importance of it, but not many really define it like you've just said it. So systemic is, as I'm understanding, kind of what we demonstrate probably most days and what we know to have
about ourselves. Tough you are walking into the crisis. Mm. You are walking into the fire.
And the second one was?
That when under fire, you know, the strength you demonstrate that you didn't know you had.
Huh. Interesting. I think that's
what you bring to the fight and what the fight brings out in you. Because I've seen some people, I'm like, oh, you're not going to do well. And under stress and crisis, they show something. So it's what you bring to the fight and what the fight brings out in you. Systemic resilience is what you bring to the fight. You got it in you. And processive resilience is what the fight brings out in you.
That's superb. That's absolutely superb. This is like non-relevant to surgery, but that to put that example into the real world, we recently did a campaign with a car manufacturer called Seat. And we did some work with them around mental health awareness, which it was Mental Health Awareness Week this week just gone. And we created four videos where we provided practices that can help people, which I'd love to speak with you about what you use, but help them to manage their mental health. One of them was about music. And we had this musician from the UK planned to be in the video. We're going to interview him and just hear his views on it. Cancelled on the morning, and we only had the videographer for that day. So we were thrust into a situation where we didn't have an alternative. We had to come up with something there and then. And we've now put all the videos out. And on reflection, that was by far the best video we made versus the other ones, which we spent weeks or months putting together scripts, storyboards, and all this other stuff, planning it all. But when it got to this crisis moment that we had, again, not comparable to illness or cancer, but in this business world, it created something far better than what we'd imagined in the first place. So I think that's really interesting that you explained it like that.
And I like that mention. So the lessons the lessons apply at the daily level. Listen, that's an extremely stressful environment. So stress and pain is a personal dimension. Just like that in the operating room, there are crises and obstacles you face that you can't see in a book. You know, it's crisis management. And often that's where some creativity or new approach is born. So we don't want to have stress and crises, but if there's a way to put it to use, then that builds your, systemic resilience. That makes you like, next time I'm not going to be so afraid of that. I can manage that. I can manage some of these things not working. I did it last time. I learned this. I didn't learn that. But it takes rumination. It takes deliberate thinking. You don't go through it and then just see what happens. Like, it takes reflection. You know, not to perseverate over it, but just you got to look back and then say, okay, all things were falling apart. I had these couple opportunities. I went this way. I went that way. This is that kind of worked out, I think. And what that does is it gives you that, like, it adds emotional regulation. So the next time you get to it, the freak out factor is a little less. You're like, okay, I've handled that fight and I've handled this thing. I've handled that thing. I think I can get through it this way. Then that operation went this way, but that one was this way. If I connect those two, I can handle it. That's systemic resilience. That's life. On the other side is Captain Sullenberger, Captain Sully, who landed that plane in the, and then people are like, hero, hero, hero. I met him at a launch Los Angeles television studio, just briefly. I mean, so composed. He should be president of several countries. I mean, just grit, gravitas, composed, smart, just talented. And what we shared was that they brought the pilot how to reduce errors in flights to how to reduce errors in the operating room. So there's a little bit of an overlap with that. Mm-hmm. And we had our conversation, and I didn't broach it directly, but when the movie came out, after doing that, right, you had all these people behind you, your engines are out, you're like, can't make the run. Oh my gosh. I can't imagine. I'm curious about what his emotional regulation was. Did he pull it off while freaking out, or did he activate some breathing ritual he has or developed over 20, 30, 40 years of flying? I'm curious about his sort of the brain physiology and electricity. At the same time, after that legendary, he struggled with his own mental health quite a bit. And so I think, that's what I mean about the earlier example. How can I judge that, you know, is there going to be a parade after that moment for you? Do you walk around saying, I'm the best, look what I did, I landed that? Or are you actually wrecked from that crisis that you pulled off and managed? And I love that about him was that we have every reason to think he was going to be like Neil Armstrong, but it really destroyed him psychologically a bit. To where he did not have constructive coping mechanisms. And I just thought, okay, so be careful what you wish for. And so this journey with my patients, it's sort of a, you know, I felt like in the beginning I was traumatized what they were going through. And now I'm sort of fortified by having seen their journey, but not really having to bear the full weight, right? I'm not the one with cancer. I'm with them, but it, you know, affects me. I mean, it's, you know, I lose sleep over it, but then I walk away. So I feel guilty that I don't, when their plane crashes, I bail out. I had a lot of issues with that. But now I see it as an opportunity that they have allowed me to join them in their most intimate and moments of crises and depth. And so I have to be to put meaning to this, I have to learn from them. Otherwise, that's just patient number 2024. It can't be that way for me, you know. And that's where we're at, man.
Yeah. Unbelievable example with the Sully landing in the Hudson River as well. There's so many things to draw on with what you do as well. You mentioned then just about how when the plane crashes, you bail out. So I think what you're alluding to there is, so if a patient's procedure doesn't go successfully, you live to fight another day and they're not here. Is that what you mean?
Right. Or yeah. when their years are up, I keep living. You know, I can't save them. They understand that. I understand that. You know, it's like always coming into a burning airplane, pulling up the nose for a few years and then parachuting out, and then they go on, you know. So I've tried to, you know, I've tried to put that in a better place with what I've learned from all those crashing airplanes, you know, that is the journey. But I chose this. I'm not a victim by any means. I'm grateful. I thank them for letting me join them on their journey.
Is that the difference between coping with that and being at peace with it? Is that the victim mentality versus having gratitude for your position? Yeah.
Oh, but there's no way to cope, man. It's just, thousands of patients I've cared for have died. I mean, I don't know how to put that. It's a brilliant question you just asked. That's the nuance that I think this book will afford, and what we're trying to have in this conversation is, I haven't coped. I haven't, I'm not mindful about, you know, it's not in a good place, man. It's not a good thing to have. You can't put the word good or bad or cope or not cope. I'm at peace with the fact that thousands of patients have relied upon me. I have done my best. They have not lived. I have lived. Not because there was a mistake, but that's the journey they were on. They came to me in the last few miles of their marathon, and I tried to help them get further. Mm-hmm. And I'm at peace with that. I mean, do I think of certain patients and if it tears me up? Oh, yeah. Is that constructive coping or destructive coping? I don't know. But just like I would never judge what a parent goes through when a child passes away. The ones who know me best and the ones who care for me, they understand that there's no way to understand what that experience is like to be a cancer surgeon for over 20 years. That is in my own personal journey. And I've tried to find some meaning and purpose from them. But I'm at peace with it, but it doesn't feel good.
Well, I was going to say, I can imagine. I don't know if I can. My dad often says to me, regardless of what we're going through, whatever the circumstances, as long as we can truly say to ourselves that we acted in good faith, we did our best, then that helps us with that journey.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's good advice.
Rahul, I'm so sorry. Could you just give me 1 minute? My wife is blowing up my phone. I just need to put my dog away.
I've got to do something too. And as long as you keep this part in the podcast and don't splice it out, that we just took a break to take care of our loved ones and dog and stuff like that.
100%. That's real.
That's funny, right? That's exactly real. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's both. I'll be 1 minute.
All right. Thanks. No editing this.
Here's my dog, by the way.
Oh, man. I feel better already.
This is the best therapist in the world.
I'll tell you about the one we got a year ago. It kept my family together.
Oh, really? I bet. Honestly,
rescued, man. By a rescue.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I'll be back in 1 sec.
Yeah. Take your time. Don't rush.
Right. Where were we? I think what I'll move into. Did you hear that?
Mm-mm.
That's my 10-month-old. She just got home.
Oh. So that's first baby?
First baby.
Oh, that's life-changing.
So that's, you know, when we talk about self, I'll ask you about that for sure, because that's changed a lot. But
that's the first time I started actually paying attention was when my son was born. Mm-hmm. You know, 27. Up till then, I was just going wild and getting things done. And then I started thinking about, wait a second, I want to impact him. I didn't know how, but I wanted to leave my impact on my children. So it's not just about success. There's so much more than that. But I wanted to have an influence and impact on them. And now he's almost 20. Can you believe it?
So, wow.
Yeah. Wow. He's taller than me. He's going to college, university. And the other ones are essentially 17 and 16. And that's the first 14, am I just, you know, when they were younger, I enjoyed them. But from like 12 to 15, that's really when I started opening up the mic in my head to them, just traveling with them internationally. What do you think of that? What do you think of that? What do you think of this food? What should you read on this? Just trying to get into their heads in a positive way, teaching them from the lessons I had. It was so, and then they turn about 15, 16, and they can't be found. So just realize your windows are playtime for now. Like the way I think about it is when they're young, put them in gymnastics, get them physically sound and coordinated, hold them, love them, get the language tight. I never, you know, people are like, oh, you're a brain surgeon. You must be pushing school. Oh, man, not at all. We just they'll be fine. We want them to have sort of a breadth of social interactions and physical interactions and feeling of safety and warmth and love. And then I dialed it up when they got to be like, you know, in 12 and 13. So what do you think about this? Let's read this article together. What do you think about this? Where are they going with this? You know, really coaching was 12 to 15, 12 to, you know, 11 to 14. After that, just let them fly. Then you sit back and you see how they do and they start telling some of the stories. I saw one of my sons. He's like, yeah, well, that was the time I went to, you know, I went fishing, or I know there was the other one. That's the time my father and I, we went to Russia. And I was like, oh, he's bragging about all that stuff I was dealing with. I'm just sitting back now. I'm just sitting back now and seeing how they're putting it all together. And I've influenced them. I've impacted them. And we'll see what they do with it, you know.
Amazing to hear. I've got all that ahead of me. She's 10 months and it's just been the biggest blessing in the world. I've changed. Yeah. Dramatically, I think, like, just the way I view my lens of the world has just changed. I'm not selfish. Well, I'm still selfish, but I'm not as selfish anymore. It's the first time I've, you know, you can understand things on a level. And I always kind of knew that I put myself first and the world revolved around me. And you have this feeling of a sense of self that everything impacts you. You don't consider others as much. And this has really dawned on me. In fact, I thought about this like in the shower this morning. It really just hit me. I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
Everything that happens to me impacts other people too.
Yeah.
And they all have their own shit too.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, again, we were talking about educations and how trauma can educate like children. She's been the biggest education as well.
I know that fuck moment happened for me when my first one was born and my wife had a C-section. So she was on pain pills. And like the first night, about the size of this microphone, and I'm lying there. And he's on my chest from like Adam's apple to like not even down to my stomach. And I'm just like, oh man, it begins. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he would have done fine anywhere else, but it began for me. It began for me. I was like, this is the selfishness I want to have. I'm selfish about my love for my son. I'm selfish to see him turn into something. That is his potential, not an outcome, not a job, not a career. No. Just the cultivation of his mind and spirit and body. I was really into that. So that big boy of mine, he's 20. I was talking about the other year, that day with him. We started running through the map and we were like Panama, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Bolivia, Peru, Ukraine, London. I mean, England, of course. Russia, we just started going through the map in Asia. And I thought, you know what? Those weren't family trips. I took him to 9 countries, just me and him. By the time he's 19, I thought, you know what? That was well done. That's the proper kind of selfishness. I enjoyed those trips. I was rolling out doing surgery and somebody was with us. They'd watch me, just been everywhere, man. Just the connection you have with that. And I did that with the second boy and I'm doing that with the third boy too. That's motivated. I'm selfish for that. I want that time with them. You know, it's good selfishness if there is such a thing, but that was by design. I encourage you to, that's where the parenting happens. That's where the memories, the memories are glacial, but that's where like the conversational memories happen. Oh yeah, that time. Yeah, what were you doing in Panama? What were you doing in Peru at Machu Picchu? Alone with him, father and son. And I've done that with all three of my boys. And that's, you know, it's kind of letting me, we're a digression, but I think it's very important. You said about doing things with good faith and being at peace. It's allowing me now to step back and just watch them with their girlfriends, with their boyfriends, with their family, with other people. I can be a spectator in their lives and really sit back and enjoy because I parented them with dedication and with good faith, you know. And that's, again, that's liberating because I'm not looking back and saying, I wish I would have, I wish I could have, you know. Now I'm like, see where this goes.
You've earned that like feeling of no regret.
Well said.
Huh. It sounds amazing. How does it feel? Because I have these thoughts of everything flashing in front of me. Like we just took her into nursery for 30 minutes yesterday, like this one of these settling in sessions, so that we take her in for 45 minutes tomorrow, and you know, we get her used to this thing. And it's like this year is just flown by. She's going to be one in seven weeks. And yeah, how do you feel like with your eldest now getting ready to go to college, and how quick that 20 years has gone?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, but I have no regret, because I got an extra year with the pandemic. He stayed down. He stayed here with us with the first year of his college. I put in some mileage with him internationally. One time, so in February of 2020, I was telling some people close to me, you know, hey, this thing's going to blow. This pandemic is going to, and they're like, and he told one friend and I heard him saying, and I want you to know that this is from my dad, who is the least alarmist person on the planet. He took me to Ukraine when I was 14. And when I said, isn't there a war going on? He said, no, that's on the eastern edge. We're going to be on the western edge. He's just got it, you know? And so just the conversation, the thinking, the explanation, he's like, that guy who would take a son to Nicaragua that like 2 years later had political instability and was like, I've taken him to Nicaragua and Ukraine, not the usual places. And I was telling everybody that was close to me that asked that in February, I said, this thing's going to blow. And those kind of lessons with them are important. But if I look back, so I got a good friend, Greg White. He's an Olympian for England, and he's also got a PhD in physiology. And sometimes that conversation is the best, because we kind of know each other's space. And looking back, what I would say is they got to feel safe. They may not be safe. Like we had sirens going off and bomb threats in Kashmir when I was a kid, you know, but I felt safe. I don't look back at that. You know, whatever my mom and dad did, I felt safe. Mm-hmm. Some people are behind gated communities in Los Angeles and don't feel safe. So that feeling of that somehow making the child feel safe is super important for their threat response for the rest of their life. That thermostat, be careful with that. Number two, they're not born moving like the gazelle that just lands and moves, right? So my buddy Greg White mentioned that. He said, I think every kid should do 6 months of gymnastics, not to go into it, but just learn how to somersault and move, just to get maximally coordinated with their limbs and balance. I thought that's brilliant, man. What, you don't have to do anything after that, but set that thermostat also, using the left hand, how to fall. Mm-hmm. And then keep in mind that psychiatric illnesses, they tend to pop late adolescent, early 20s. Like there's if you look at schizophrenia, it happens like this, the story in medical school is 22-year-old male in college or 19-year-old female in university. All of a sudden, those things that are whatever's going on with the brain, late teens. And I think we know this, but I would just impart upon people that there's a electrochemical shifting. It's not like structurally it's doing anything. There are no wires. I'm trying to get people to think of the brain as an ecosystem. And we use words like that. When you're born, you actually have more neurons, then you prune them. And then the ones, because you don't need some of them, you're not activating some of them. So the brain says, hey, I'm going to let those go. But the ones you do have, by interacting and engaging, they grow more branches. The term is arborization. So pruning and arborization are true neuroscience, like hardcore neuroscience terms. So if we get away from wires, which implies a directionality, and get to, I want more branching in my neurons, and we get to seasons of growth and winters of dormancy, that's real biology. I mean, I'm not like just... This isn't like some creative thing, man. I might send you papers with language in there. So I'm trying to bring that language here rather than we're wired for this, we're wired for that. And so if you see your teenager's mind as as branching in certain ways, and those electric neurons are spraying chemicals and electricity, it should inspire people. Like, I want to have a close engagement, if possible, in this window. So the physical window is, you know, learning to walk and all those things, you know, five and below. The safety window is your whole life, but especially early. And for me, the just getting in their head, you know, age 11 to 15 was a strategy that I had. I might have failed, you know, if they would have not done well. Doesn't mean, I'm just saying, like, I can't guarantee the outcome. But that those approaches, I hope people will hear, have a biological basis for why I'm saying that. Hmm. Not just do it now, do it then. But there are shifts going on in the mind and electricity of the brain in late teens. Your arms and legs are learning to connect with your brain, five and under. And that thermostat for threat and vigilance, you want to dial that appropriately. Because if you don't help them set that, then later on in life, they're going to feel under threat when there isn't. And that can be, you know, that can get in the way of really a well-lived life.
That's unbelievable advice. That's unbelievable advice. I mean, it's hard. Yeah. I think and still believe very strongly that one of the best things my parents ever did was tell me that I could achieve anything. And I have people who disagree with that and feel like that you shouldn't, you know, fill a teenager's head with the thoughts that they can do whatever, because it can lead to arrogance and overconfidence or whatever. But I still believe that that gave me a sense of self-belief that meant that I can go on and go anywhere and do anything. And I don't feel like it's fair for people not to feel like that in this world. There are so many opportunities available to us, and it sounds like you have a similar belief.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Did I tell them? I used sort of a modified version of that with the kids, you know, and maybe it was a bit competitive, but well, if someone else had done it, then surely you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that's at the highest levels of achievement. So before you do something that the world hasn't seen yet, before you really just make us think differently, like a certain musician or an artist or a certain surgeon that does an operation, you're like, wait a second, that's brand new, and the generations will be doing that afterwards. Or a leader that transforms us, or an astronaut that makes us see the world differently from the perspective of the moon looking down. Like, well, people have done that. So I never said to them, you can do anything, but I said, surely you can do what others have done, you know? And I always told them the way to approach it is just straight dedication and hard work to get to base camp. Hmm. We can all just, you know, I see that in medical training. It's not necessarily filled with talented people, but it's filled with dedicated people. So I said, just muscle it to base camp. Everybody can get to 16,000 feet at the base of Everest. I know it's crowded now, so the example is not as apropos, but get to base camp. And then you're in a position to summit. The summit isn't guaranteed in life, but find what you're aiming for. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, when I dropped out of university, I was like, man, if I could just become a physician of any sort type, I just want to help people. That was my base camp. You know, I was even looking to go to medical schools that weren't in America because I had such terrible grades in college, and I dropped out, and they were looking at all these stellar students, and then, oh, and this guy, he's a mess. And I don't blame him, but that was my base camp. And then from there, oh, it's been an amazing journey into brain surgery and brain science and talking to you. And now, you know, what happened 2 years ago in London, how a person named Venetia Butterfield from Penguin set me up. She took a book I had in America and said, if I change the title and I change the cover and I change and get back to proper spelling, you know, C-O-L-O-U-R rather than this American. I mean, I didn't see that potential in me. She set me up and made me relevant for a moment in London. Like, so that's summiting. But the base camp was becoming a physician. So that way I leave, you know, so you can do anything, especially if others have done it. Mm-hmm. But in the pursuit of that, don't forget to secure base camp, which is like shelter, food, you know, because that's when you can really take your shots, when you've got your, you know, you've got your day-to-day living isn't under threat. So that's why I'm so impressed with some of my patients who their housing situations aren't secure. That's why I'm impressed with certain people who have, who are under threat for a lot of different reasons. Yet they aspire, yet they aim to summit. That's tremendous to me. I've had the luxury of being born to the right parents who provided that thermostat and that exposure and that stability for me. But I, you know, I've got a buddy who, you know, was in El Salvador and came to America at 15 illegally at first, you know, and he's a physician. I look at the stories around me and I start to think, man, I haven't achieved much because I was given so much. So I'm impressed with people who really, they look at the same external environment. They say, I can do it. Anything is possible. So I like what your dad said. My story might not be anything is possible, but I have seen plenty of stories where there is no explanation of why they have triumphed so well. And so I think it's important. Yeah, anything is possible, especially if other people have done it. But don't forget, dedication will take you to base camp where those triumphs are possible.
It's such an amazing metaphor. I love it. Yeah. And actually, it was my mum who probably said that more than my dad. But yeah, I love, you know, so many metaphors around mountains. That's literally one of my favorites. I'm so pleased you said that. I'm going to hang on to that.
Thanks, man.
And actually, it's again, I said earlier, books come into your life at the right time. That's just come into my life at the right time because from I used to be an athlete as well. I played football. So achieving things in sport, achieving things at school in academics, achieving things in business, that was all fine because other people had done it. It was easy to believe you could do it if another human had done it. I'm in this space now where with a podcast and with how I work with clients as a coach and this kind of world, which there isn't really a hard and fast formula on making this work. So it's the first time in my life where I'm thinking, okay, I can do anything, but how the fuck do I do this?
Yeah.
there's no formula here. So
that's funny. I'm having similar experience with the journey in UK. It's there is no formula, and actually there isn't an exact person to follow because it's my journey that's resonating, hopefully. And I fell in love with London. You know, I haven't felt at home in really my whole life, and it was great to add London as a potential home. And now I'm just seeing that I have many homes and many places, and but it is a bit unnerving, the uncertainty of saying I'm going to go for it, but there aren't these 10 steps to follow. And medical school and training is very much like this year you do this, next year you do that. I was in medical school for 4 years and training for 8. I mean, for 12 years, I mean, it was like, you know, every year was drawn out. And now not even today is drawn out. And that takes adjustment. But I think from that uncertainty, there's also a constructive pressure that releases creativity. If it's too regimented, you can't cut loose. And if you don't cut loose, you're not going to come up with something fresh. And what you think is fresh, others may not. And so then the burden of the creative process, from my perspective, is you got to come up with a lot of fresh shit. You know what I mean? It can't be like, I got it. You got to have output. You got to have productivity in a creative space. And so you got to keep going to that well. And that's not easy. I have a lot of respect for people who do that. Because, you know, you build that well through your life, and then you get your first book or your first sort of, you know, I always just think about Snoop Dogg's first album. Well, Dre called it Chronic. He found him in Long Beach, and the album says The Chronic is by Dr. Dre, but most of the songs are by Snoop Dogg. And they were so compelling. Every word was, because that was the stuff he was probably thinking about for the last 10 years. If I get my shot, this is what I got. And Dre heard that, and he's like, those are all gold. Nobody knows you. I'm on the cover, but you know, and then the next, and then I thought the real challenge is what's next. Book 2, album 2. That's where I've started to see, and in surgery, what do you do when the professor's not there? They train you, they teach you these things. Do you advance the field of surgery more than what you have learned. Those spaces come with uncertainty, just the way you're mentioning, right? I don't know where to go with it. And that's where I think that's where my personal growth has happened. Under the pressure of uncertainty. Uncertainty in operating room, uncertainty in relationships, uncertainty in physically being in different places. But now I'm starting to see it as a gift. Like that's the way to replenish the well. So where I can pull out more creative content.
When you talk about this well, do you mean like this inner well of strength? Is this what you're going back to? Or
Well, I mean, physically this world, I've lived in a lot of places and I move in a lot of places, you know, and that is also those experiences that comes with a bit of uncertainty, but also those experiences replenish the well, I would say, where do you keep going to for your creative content? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's been travel, interacting with people, of course, my patients, my personal journey, physically living in different parts of the world. Having tremendous family and friends and people that we go hard, man. We vibe like this. We just go, just go. And there doesn't, I can't tell you what will come out of this, but you have added to the well where later something creative will surface.
Please, mate, I'm getting so much from this. I'm absolutely loving it. It's interesting. You're talking about uncertainty and the mindset of somebody who considers taking something further, like you said, do you advance medicine or do you just kind of stick to the rules and follow what people have done before you? And the example that came to my mind then is, I don't know if you follow rugby or not, but the New Zealand All Blacks, and they have a mindset or a philosophy that they take the shirt and they leave it in a better place than where they had than where it was before. And I think that separates so many people to think about taking something further than where it is now, leaving it in a better place. Rather than, you know, you could argue, and I apologize because I've had a lot of England rugby players on my podcast, but you could say the England rugby players might not have the same sort of philosophy. So yeah, I just thought that was such a great example that you mentioned. It just came up for me there.
Yeah, and you got that, you know, you got Jordan back there. He's actually mentioned in my book. People will be surprised if brain surgery mentioning Jordan, but you know, there was a selfishness in the way he played that I think that can be respected also. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't hurt people, if you don't get in the way of other people's success, if it's an open competition where the rules are established, that's why I love sport. I got on ESPN a couple times and I was like, I was on that sports center. some of my friends were like, you know, my wife was like, oh, that's cool. That's fine. But I was like, no, it's like, you know, it's like getting on Oprah or like Nightly News or getting on BBC, whatever. But being on SportsCenter was just because I respect sport because it's an open competition. Whereas sometimes you see people competing and they're just trying to take advantage of each other. And I struggle with business that way, where you're just trying to outdo each other and the rules aren't completely structured. But I love, here are the rules, here are the uniforms, here's a referee. It's just, and surgery can be like that. Here is a challenging cancer. There are people in all the major centers taking on those types of cancers. And some are better. Some are physically better at getting all of it. Some are physically better at getting all of it and hurting you less. And that's why surgery is just the thing, man, because, and it's a team sport kind of, but it's an individual sport too. And I think that's why I wanted to go into cancer surgery because knee replacements, they all look the same. You're trying to go from 92% affected to 92.2. Cancer surgery, the cancer grows different. It eats up the anatomy different. When you go in there, it's almost like a new enemy every time. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to like dissect the cancer that's grown a different way in a patient whose anatomy has been eaten up in a different way. It's a physical thing. I mean, there's a whole table of tools. There's a headlight on my head. There are telescopic glasses. That's a physical performance. And what I saw was there are efficient surgeons. It's not like we all do the same 1,000 steps. For a routine operation, it's not like do 1 through 100. If you're slick and if you're soft, you can do the same work in 62 steps, where somebody else might take a little bit more steps, more tissue injury. So that's one world. Then on the other side is dangerous surgery. Some people, if the patient chooses it, trauma surgery, cancer surgery, transplant surgery, if the patient chooses it, there are people who are physically better at it than others. So when you get medicine in LA or New York, it's the same bag and the same plastic thing, right? It's made in a factory. But what if your disease required the medicine of somebody's physical dexterity and capacity to perform under pressure? What if there was a surgeon in LA or New York or London that for this type of cancer, patients did much better in his hands? Like, that's sport. And some of the best ones I've seen, they bring the same Michael Jordan perspective. Every little inefficiency, they're just, they're bent out of shape about it. And that's what Jordan mentioned, like, just, I've missed the game-winning shot this many times. They're like, you're Michael Jordan. He's like, yeah, but those shots I missed. And my buddies and I are like them, the people I know. There's just, I only remember the people I hurt and the ones I could have done better with. They're like, but you, this and this. I'm like, oh, yeah, but that's. And so you have that thing behind you with Jordan. That's exactly the same way. So under the chapter failure, he's mentioned in there about what drives people. But the open competition is the most important thing. I think that's healthy competition. Here are the rules. Here are the goals. International. Doesn't matter what you were before or not. It's under these lights we see who you are. I love that about surgery. I love that about sport.
It's much easier to measure performance as well under those.
Exactly. There's no judge. Exactly. It went in the basket.
Yeah. Yeah.
That cancer came out.
Yeah.
No, exactly. That takes out the biases that we all have naturally, you know.
But that's great, because you were saying about a patient might be better in somebody else's care, like in your care, like
somebody else's. I'm not saying me, or a few things I'm good at.
Yeah, when the drill or the suture or whatever is in your hands, the same as Michael Jordan when the ball's in his. And you know, I finished your book. I just got the Nipsey Hussle biography, and I imagine there might be some similarities in the life stories between you guys. Different backgrounds.
He's LA, and when he. There were a lot of murals about him, and I think even Obama, you know, put something out. But what I would say is, you know, so, you know, rap and art has an arbiter, a judge. But in surgery, we measure who has the best resection rates and who has the lowest complication rates. So, you know, you get like, you know, goals and you know, fouls and rebounds and stuff like that. There are metrics in surgery that don't require a judge. You know, the scan tells it, the patient's disability or lack of it tells it. So I love that part about surgery and being a surgeon.
Yeah, I bet. And thank you, by the way, you're making this very easy for me, because you're bringing me back to what I want to talk about, which is the surgery aspect. I've been dying to talk about the performance side of surgery and being a brain surgeon. Before I do, I just want to thank you again. I'm loving this conversation so much. There are certain ones, and I love all the conversations I have for the podcast, but there are certain ones when I feel it deeply, and I'm getting that today. So I'm enjoying it.
Perfect, man.
Wow. Dr. Rahul Jindia calling in all the way from Los Angeles, California. I'm so sorry to cut you guys off mid-conversation, but part two is coming this Wednesday in 3 days' time, where we talk all about what it's like to actually perform in the operating theatre. It is insane. In the meantime, you can pick up Rahul's brand new book, Life on a Knife's Edge. I hope you enjoyed part one. As mentioned, part two coming this Wednesday. We'll see you then.